I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. College might not be for everyone, but there are other ways to learn a trade. Today, Reskilling America. We take a look at vo-tech options starting in high school and how they could be critical in bringing industry back to the U.S. Then we'll find out how Kansas City can find inspiration in other countries about urban design and planning a better city. Finally, chances are good you've seen them parked outside your office or roaming the West Bottoms. We're talking about food trucks. Sure, they make great food accessible, but there's more to the biz than simply serving sliders from a van. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to KCUR's Up to Date. We're talking business today by highlighting some of our favorite conversations from last year. First up, we look at filling industry jobs in America by reskilling our workforce. There is no argument that a good education leads to better and better paying job opportunities. However, that education doesn't have to be 4 or more years at a university. So says our next guest. Catherine Newman is provost and Tory Little professor of sociology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and co-author of Reskilling America, Learning to Labor in the 21st Century. She joins us by Skype this morning. And Catherine, thank you for taking some time.
Thank you for having me.
And here in the studio with me is Susie Goldsmith. She is assistant director of the Fort Osage Career and Technology Center out in Independence. And Susie, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Catherine, you say America is bringing industry back to this country, but we don't have enough skilled workers to fill the jobs that are coming, many that require training. Training, you say, that doesn't have to come from 4 years of college. So where can it come from?
Well, if we look at how other countries achieve these goals, it comes from in high schools, it comes in technical colleges, it can come through apprenticeship, which is a critical part of this picture, because the kind of training that this workforce will need needs to be both in the classroom, usually forms of physics and mathematics and engineering strengths, and on the shop floor with real world applications and the opportunity to work with the equipment that's really at the cutting edge. So when we look at how other countries achieve these goals, it tends to be through extremely high quality technical education, often provided by people in community colleges and in high schools who have industry experience themselves, and shop floor experience over a number of years through the apprenticeship model that has been more popular in Europe than it has been in the U.S.
You know, Susie, we spent decades in this country with the goal of, you know, college for everybody. Why does that mindset need to change from your vantage point?
I think that there's a gap that we found, a skills gap, and that gap doesn't necessarily get fixed by going to college. There are so many different avenues that need to happen to fix that.
Catherine, another thing that's changed is a stereotype of vocational technical schools, which is not the preferred term these days. Tell us what CTE stands for and how it's erasing the stigma of vocational training from when I went to high school.
CTE stands for Career and Technical Education, and it is an effort to rebrand this kind of training, which is really very high tech. It's oriented toward the most elevated skills. It requires a lot of intelligence. It requires devotion to the practice world. And there is an effort to try and rebrand it in order to think of it as a productive future with a good job at the other end. It isn't just in manufacturing, though. This is in information technology. It's in healthcare. There's so many areas in which what we call middle skill jobs are critical for the nation's productivity. We're trying to draw attention to the enormous gulf in the preparation of our labor force that we're going to need, right, to be a productive country.
Well, and Susie, speaking of that, you already have 14 different programs out at Fort Osage. How many students are there and what grade can they enter the program?
We have approximately 500 students, and for most of the programs, the students enter as a junior, and it's a two-year program. There are a few that they can, like marketing and agriculture, they can enter in as a freshman.
Catherine, just to illustrate where CTE graduates can end up, what type of job he or she can get, and how much they can be earning, you know, out of the box just within a few years?
Yes, let me give you some examples from South Carolina, where high school students are in their regular high schools during half of the day, and the other half of the day they come into a regional training center, which provides them with the kind of training they need to enter mechatronics, to enter advanced manufacturing, to enter IT, and they receive training in that technical setting from industry professionals. And that is coupled with apprenticeship on the shop floor of the companies that hope to hire them when they're through. That model will qualify people to work, for example, in heavy manufacturing. But heavy manufacturing today is very much a matter of using computer technology and quality control, and it requires a knowledge of basic engineering and acquaintance with computer programming. And that's really what's needed even in manufacturing, for example, diesel engines, which is what one company in South Carolina does to prepare people for their industry.
You know, in the book, you ask a question that for many students and maybe their parents too, Catherine, might put this whole debate into perspective. Complete CTE courses and enter the job market with a job that pays $75,000 a year, or graduate from college $75,000 in debt. Who can benefit the most from occupational courses?
Well, I think it should be open to everyone, because there are just such a wide variety of talents that we need in the economy. I don't want anyone to walk away from your program thinking that the kind of university where I work is somehow irrelevant. In fact, I think we're an important part of this ecosystem in general. The kinds of careers we're talking about now are these middle skill jobs, which require this technical training, but they do offer a robust salary at the end. And the other thing we should note is that it doesn't close the door on coming back into the university world should people decide that they want even more training. So if you were going to go into mechatronics, you would need this kind of technical training. But if you thought later on you wanted to be a design engineer, you'd probably have to come back into the university world. These pathways are not dead ends. They open up new vistas, but in the meantime can provide those students who want it with an opportunity to earn a good living and begin to raise a family.
You know, Susie Goldsmith, again, with the Fort Osage Career and Technology Center, what's the makeup of the student body? I mean, the percentage of boys and girls, and how diverse is the program?
The makeup of students is almost 50-50, and it just depends on the program that you're in as to where you have traditional students. In our health science class, it's predominantly females. In our mechanics classes, it's predominantly males. But it doesn't mean that we don't have a token here or there of the opposite sex. I think the
beauty... So it's 50-50, but some stereotypes linger here, it sounds
like. Yeah. And the beauty of it is the mix of all the different students that you get, because you've got culinary arts students that have their own flair, and you've got your computer engineering students that have their own wonderful geeky ways. So it's just it's a great blend.
Are many looking to go to college eventually?
We have about 63% of the students that are going to continue their education in some way.
Yeah. What would you say those students are looking to get from their educations at the center? What's their objective?
I think that they have a passion for the industry that they're going into, and so they're craving more information on that and wanting to get a leg up from the other students that are going to go on and continue their education. They also really like getting the credentials. There's definitely industry-recognized credentials that they can add to their resume that will help them in their next career step. And I think that industry is calling so much for credentials that there's a balance that they have to find there, whether they continue their education or whether they just look for more credentials.
Catherine Newman, who's co-author of Reskilling America, Learning to Labor in the 21st Century. You know, not every skill set learned through CTE is going to land a good paying job. Home health care, for example, big issue out here in Missouri. They're fighting to raise the minimum wage. What should students look at before selecting a CTE course of study, Catherine?
Yeah, fair enough. Not every middle skill job is remunerated as it should be. That's a national problem we should be looking at, because we do think our elderly and our young children should have high quality care. but we often don't pay the people who provided what they really deserve. But for the student who's selecting a field, I think that the same thing applies to them as would apply if they were coming to my university. What are they interested in? Where do they feel their talents really lie? What kinds of skills will they be able to develop, and are those congenial to them? The student who feels that they're really ready for sort of entry-level engineering courses with the kind of work you have to do in math and physics may be a little bit different than the student who really feels their forte or their passion in life is caring for people who need support. It's a matter of matching your personality and ambitions to the opportunities out there. I have to say, though, you know, while home health care is not well paid, if you look ahead to the ranks of the nursing profession, you know, you start to see other opportunities open up, and it may well be that there's a serial career there for someone who finds the healthcare industry to be their particular niche in life.
Hmm. What are some of the growth industries coming down the pike, Catherine? Where's the opportunity down the road?
So the opportunity is definitely in information technology, in construction, in or what we call advanced manufacturing. These are all growth areas in the U.S. You know, the healthcare professions are a growth area because it's tied to an aging population that requires this support. We have a lot of demand for people who are interested in early childhood education. So that's sort of the link between daycare and the earliest years of formal schooling. These are all areas that matter. There is a lot of demand for people who have better training in managerial occupations, in the management of human resources.
Right.
Those are some of the areas that are growing.
Susie, how about at the Career and Technology Center? What are some of the most popular programs out there?
I would say that our health science class is definitely very popular. Culinary arts is popular. We have a law enforcement CSI.
Culinary arts is just a big deal all over the metro.
Indeed.
That industry seems to be just enduring year after year. Yeah. How many of your programs provide certification for students if they're successful in completing the coursework in front of them?
13 of the 14.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, for example, our culinary arts class, they have ACF certification that they can receive, a student ACF certification.
And Catherine, once they had that certification, what does that mean? What does that get them?
Well, it will bring them to the attention of employers who are looking for restaurant staff that are really well-skilled and that can help them build a reputation for their industry. The high-end restaurants are really looking at people with this kind of advanced training. The one thing we're not going to outsource or offshore is eating. That's going to be done here, more or less forever, as far as we can tell.
I want to get to the German model of career education, Catherine, because in the book you quote a remarkable figure that the unemployment rate among young people in Germany is at 7%, when so many other countries are in double digits. There are three major forks in the road for German students: fourth grade at the age of 14, and once they hit 16. What happens at each of those stages?
At each of those stages, German students are introduced to a wide palette of opportunities, and they also take various exams that sort of point the way in terms of their capacities. But there's a lot in Germany that's going in the U.S. direction at providing more on-ramps and off-ramps so that people can mix and match those programs. And at one time in the past in Germany, as is true in most of Europe, these were really one-way streets. But both in Germany and elsewhere, this is starting to become more of a mix and match process than it was in the past. But in Germany, generally, you have what's called the dual education program, and that combines vocational education, standard regular education, and shop floor apprentices. And that tends to begin around the age of 16 and is a three-year commitment. So people end up at 19 with full credentials if they pass very demanding national examinations in 350 different career programs.
Wow.
The firms have a high role in determining what skills they're looking for. People really sweat these exams. These are not easy. So the credentials they confer are highly respected.
Well, Catherine, what about a kid, though, who's a late bloomer and decides, you know, later on in life that he or she wants to move on to college and not go the VOTEC route?
Well, in the U.S., that's very easy because we have lots of second chance programs. We are the ultimate flexible society with respect to enabling people to come back to school. And the Europeans are starting to take another look at our system because they recognize that making these decisions at a young age can end up being not the perfect fit. So in Germany, for example, they are starting to look again at on-ramps back into higher education I think the one thing Americans really don't have to worry about is being boxed in forever to one particular pathway.
Now, we're sitting here talking about all this, and yet you write in the book that there are 600,000 manufacturing jobs that are going unfilled in this country. We've been talking about the need to grow the manufacturing sector of our economy for years now, and we can't fill all the jobs.
Yeah, well, we need to develop a more robust and continuous investment in the kind of training that Susie and I are talking about this morning. What tends to happen in the U.S. is we get a sudden burst of enthusiasm. It often comes around when we have deep recessions and we start to worry more about unemployment. And then when that eases up, you know, we start to lose interest. We're not very consistent, whereas our competitors are very consistent. This needs to be a permanent investment because it's a permanent part of the upskilling of the labor force. And it's going to take a kind of industrial policy of the sort the U.S. doesn't really like to engage in. It's more of a free-for-all, and I think that's hurting us.
Susie, just a final point. How successful has your center been at getting employers to see the advantages of working with the programs that you guys offer?
We have a system in place where we have advisory committees that invite industry in to guide us and help us to make that connection with that next step for the student. But I also feel like that's an area of strong growth that's needed in CTE, that we partner more with the industry, that we provide more opportunities for our students to do internships, to do apprenticeships, even just starting with shadowing. I think it's an area of growth.
We're going to leave our conversation there. Catherine Newman, author of Reskilling America, she joined us by Skype this morning. Susie Goldsmith is Assistant Director of the Fort Osage Career and Technology Center out in Independence. Thank you both for a very good conversation. That conversation took place in May of last year. It's time for a break. When we return, we'll hear from a noted architect on urban design and talk with the owners of two of this area's most popular food trucks. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Yesterday, we learned about the philosophy of love. Also, we spoke with the mother of one of the shooters at Columbine High School. Find those conversations online at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, one of President Trump's close campaign advisors gives us his perspective on what makes a president. We're talking business this hour. Up next, the challenges of architectural designing for cities, embassies, and one particular university. John Rubel is co-founder and partner in the firm of Moore, Rubel, Udell Architects and Planners. For more than 30 years now, Rubel and his California-based firm have created all manner of projects, including many civic and cultural structures. John, welcome. Nice to have you.
Oh, thanks very much.
Your firm has designed projects in cities around the world. The one greatest challenge facing metros in their planning and design today is what, John?
I think it's how you integrate public opinion into the process of designing and developing cities.
Public opinion? Does that matter?
It's becoming more and more important. My hometown professionally, our office is in Santa Monica, has a ballot measure this year that would require any building over 30 feet tall to be subject to a public vote. This, of course, is going to totally bring development in Santa Monica to a standstill. So I do think public opinion is important, and I think public engagement in the development of cities is important, but it's unfortunate to see it turn into something that obstructive.
But the public isn't comprised of architects, so what do they bring to the table?
I think people who live in cities know quite well what works there and what doesn't, like the traffic problems, and that's usually kind of the kind of issue it is. It becomes harder when you really apply professional judgment and try to have an educational process. All of the things we do in Santa Monica, for example, go through many, many public workshops in different neighborhoods, really bringing out the details of the project and having a real frank discussion about how they would affect what's already there.
So engaging the public has become part and parcel of what you guys do.
It's always been part of our practice. We started back in the 70s with an approach that we engage people in the design process. So we've worked out a methodology to do this that really does get serious public input and engagement in the process, whether it's a small project like a church or a bigger project like a commercial mixed-use development.
How tough is it to create a structure these days that will not only last and serve a city for many, many years? Because, you know, these days, I mean, you obviously can't predict the future your building's going to face.
No, but we know a lot of things about the future. We know, for example, about climate change. And really, one of the strongest arguments for new development in any city is simply the fact that the old stock of buildings is not usually very energy efficient. New buildings are built to a much, much higher standard. The only way we're going to really make a contribution in terms of urban development towards the issue of climate change is by both massive remodeling and also the development of new facilities, new buildings, new centers.
That's interesting. John, what can cities do to help themselves plan and design even better and smarter than they already are?
Well, I think there's no substitute for having a good, engaged, creative planning department in the city, people at a high level professionally who really take an activist approach. You see this in European cities all the time. Development is really guided by a process. There is also a public component to that process, but plans are made that are quite specific, and development knows what the options are, knows what the opportunities are, and it really does lead, I think, to a more coherent development and a lot of advantages both for the public and for the commercial side of development.
I want to turn the conversation to some of the work of your firm, again, Moore, Rubel, Udell, starting with U.S. embassies, and this interested me a little bit. We counted four on your website, Germany, Finland, the Dominican Republic, and the Netherlands. Am I right to say that, you know, in this day and age, security is maybe the topmost concern?
Well, we, of course, in designing these projects, balance security with other concerns, and that is what makes it, in many ways, such an interesting challenge. A great example is the new embassy in Helsinki. It's won a design award from the Chicago Athenaeum, which is the first design award we've gotten on the embassy projects. It's really important as a statement of the American presence. It sits in a very prominent location on the harbor. Every boat that goes in and out of the Helsinki harbor goes right past the U.S. embassy. So our design there had to make a statement other than just this is a very secure facility.
And the statement it made was what?
Well, it shows, I think, a respect for the central place that design has in Finnish culture. The whole establishment of Finland was an establishment that was very much tied with an arts and architecture movement back in the 1915-16 period. And I think the development of the embassy shows a respect for Finland's tradition of modern architecture. It's a beautiful glassy building that lights up during the cold winter afternoons. It serves as a kind of a beacon. And it really shows, I think, a celebration and a respect for kind of Finland's tradition of modern architecture.
Do you worry about security in a country like Finland as much as you would worry about security in a country like Israel for an American embassy?
Well, we wouldn't have until a couple of years ago. There was a mass shooting in Norway.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, and that kind of thing is just a reminder that sadly there is no place, no culture, no city where things like that can't happen, and this is what the State Department tells us every day on the way to work.
So are the restrictions for security just as stringent in Norway as they would be in Israel?
Yes, every project, particularly every new project. Sometimes there's a remodeling of a historic building, and you do what you can, and that was the case in Helsinki, too. But generally speaking, very high standard, usually an increasingly high standard. And once those standards are set, there's no rolling them back, so every embassy project meets extremely complex requirements in terms of that.
You know, to what extent do these security restrictions place on the design of the building? I mean, would you design a different kind of building if you weren't so hamstrung by that?
You might, but it's about things you have to do and things that you can't do. And like any creative design problem, you always have some limitations. So I find it merely makes it more interesting.
How much does the fact that these buildings are the face of America in a foreign country influence the design?
Well, I think the most important thing with all the embassy projects that we're doing and others that the department is doing, there's a very high standard for design on a lot of levels, sustainability, functionality. We want buildings that are extremely well built. It is, in many ways, the face of the nation. So it is kind of important that way. But we're also looking simply to raise the standard of embassy design, just the way all federal design has been raised in the past and is currently. We want all of our public buildings to be demonstrations of sustainable, you know, excellent design.
Is there some characteristic that would stand out to people who even aren't trained in architecture? How would I recognize a John Ruble embassy compared to a non-embassy building?
Well, let's just say a more Ruble Dell embassy anyway. We probably go a bit further in trying to understand how can that building really reflect something about the culture and the character in the region. And each of our embassy buildings is utterly different in design, more so than even other quite good architects who might be doing embassies.
So a stereotype you're saying you're avoiding?
We do each project as a unique resultant of a whole series of considerations. But we're looking for that cultural connection. We're looking for the folks who live in that country to be able to see the building and see, I understand why that building looks like it does. And also for the Americans who work there to get a kind of heightened experience of being in the country rather than just, oh, here's the building. It looks just like Washington, D.C. Don't think stereotype. Think standards. Think, minimum goals for achievement and success and excellence raised at a very high level. That's the kind of thing we'd like to see repeated everywhere,
yeah.
Not necessarily the answers to those things.
You know, John, one of your embassies, the one in Berlin, created negative critiques, especially from some of the Germans. What were the objections?
Well, oddly enough, we designed the embassy in Berlin to really support a much bigger development that was happening there called critical reconstruction during this very historic period that both sides of the reunification of Germany. So the rebuilding of the historic core of Berlin was a huge issue. Our building, I believe, does a very significant job of that. However, because of security and some changes, we pushed the building back to get a bigger setback on a major street, and this greatly angered our previously very supportive urban design leader, Hans Stimmann, who was the author of the whole concept of critical reconstruction. These things become very political, especially in a city like Berlin. Design is something the public takes very, very seriously.
Oh, that's interesting. One other tricky project that your firm accepted was the expansion of the University of Virginia campus. Just for the record, this is the one that was designed by a guy named Thomas Jefferson. Other design proposals had already been turned down over the course of several years, and the firm that had been contracted quit out of sheer frustration. Aside from the money, why did you want to take Thomas Jefferson on and his legacy and all of that stuff at the University of Virginia?
I did ask myself that question a lot of times. And it clearly, we worked with a very conservative committee, and it clearly became an issue, no columns, no checks, which means that the College of Arts and Sciences, which very, very much needed this building in order to maintain the incredible standard they have, wouldn't get a building, and this could be actually quite a detrimental thing. So
you said no columns?
No columns, meaning no classical columns in the Jeffersonian classical tradition.
Why?
No checks. Well, here's the thing. Folks at University of Virginia take the environment more seriously than almost any other campus I know of. It's part of their heritage. It's part of their identity. All the alumni. This is a hugely important heritage that they're all extremely committed to protecting and defending. And any new building that goes up in the vicinity of the central grounds, which is the area that Jefferson designed around the lawn, comes under serious scrutiny. So we managed to find an authentic way to do a neoclassical building in a 21st century language and managed, we're very happy with it. We're very excited about it. We, first of all, designed a building that really addressed this wonderful topographic situation that you come across a public street, you cross over this beautiful grassy terrace, and you land on top of a round building that has an auditorium under it that obviously is an answer to the rotunda at the other end.
Yeah.
But there's no dome there. You walk in on top of the building and then take a stairway down. So the students, in their usual wily way, have taken to calling it the Notunda, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
The buildings addressing this little round plaza do have classic porches with columns. They also, the columns also have solar shades integrated in the porch. So there's a distinctly kind of modern element right in there with the column porches. You have to have columns.
You have to have columns. Okay, that's what I'm missing.
That's what I
here.
Said. No columns, no checks. Yeah. Meaning you have columns on your building or we're not paying for it.
Yeah, I gotcha. Besides here in the U.S., your firm works in Europe, Asia, and Caribbean countries. Who keeps track of the building regulations and codes when you're in a foreign country? And how tough can that be?
Well, we always have associates and partners in terms of local firms, especially, for instance, in China. All the projects we're doing in China, really the technical delivery of the project is taken care of by what's called a local design institute. And these LDIs have several thousand architects employed and engineers. And that's how everything happens in China. When we're doing the State Department buildings, it's interesting because we have to do both the local code and the international building code. And a lot of times they're in deep conflict with each other.
I can imagine. Well, this is your first visit to Kansas City. What do you make of our town from an architectural point of view?
Well, remember, I come from a town where there's hardly a building anywhere around that's more than two stories tall. So anytime I come to a city like this that has, I would say, a much more lush environment, you have beautiful old 20-story brick buildings from the 20s and 30s. You have huge parks, and it's very green. There's a tremendous quality of life aspect to Kansas City.
Mm-hmm. What buildings stand out to you, and which buildings do you have questions about?
Oh, well, I haven't seen that much yet to be able to say that effectively. I mean, I did very much admire the World War I Memorial and the kind of statement in the landscape that that makes and its relation to the city. I do wonder about the Performing Arts Center, its location somehow, and the way it relates to the city is a little unclear to me. I can't quite tell what it's addressing. You know, it seems in a strange way a little disconnected from what's around it in a way that it doesn't really make sense. Compared to the old train station or other train stations, which don't really have the same city context they had when they were built, but there's a front somehow, and that front establishes a place in a way that doesn't go away, even though things change around it. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think it's more difficult for contemporary architecture to make that kind of statement.
So our Union Station, do you like it?
Oh, certainly. There are several books probably that could still be done about Union Stations all around the country.
That's interesting. Well, that's John Rubel, co-founder and partner in the firm of Moore, Rubel, Udell Architects and Planners. John, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Architect John Rubel joined us last September. We Kansas Citians love our food, even more so when the food comes to us. So it makes sense that food trucks are a big deal in KC. But there's more to the biz than flipping burgers in a tricked-out van. Last April, we found out more about how these short-order rolling kitchens are outfitted for the road. You may already know that you can grab a good meal at a food truck, but did you know that food trucks got their start as chuck wagons serving meals to cowboys and then evolved into mobile canteen businesses at construction sites? We'll take a look at how modern food truck and trailer designs have further morphed their construction into gourmet kitchens on wheels. Joining us here in the studio are Chef Tito, owner of American Fusion Food Truck and Catering. Good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Chef Brett Atkinson's also here. He's owner of Wilma's Good Food Truck. Chef Brett, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Dan Sachs is also here. He's sales manager of Mag Specialty Vehicles located out in Green Valley. And Dan, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, Chef Tito, you once owned a restaurant. Why did you decide to enter the food truck business?
Well, we have a lot of issues. I think most of the restaurants have right now. And well, I decide after 36 years of working in this business, I say, I'm going to stop.
Too much hassle.
Yes, too many problems, too much taxes, too much everything. And I say, no more. This business, I can have my own time with my family and home. I can travel in and I make money. Well, you don't go to be rich, but...
But you look rich. That's all that matters.
Yeah.
Hey, how many years you been doing it?
Well, this one is my second year.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, Brett, you weren't always in the food business either. Tell us what profession you were in and why you made the switch.
Steve, I worked in the marble and tile industry for years. Always loved to cook ever since his childhood, and entertained a lot, and everybody always asked me, why don't you have a restaurant? And I was making good money, and then when the bubble popped, 2007, yeah, like millions of other Americans, I lost everything. But I still had these plans for a food truck drawn on my table. And it just gave me that opportunity to actually do what I love for a living instead of what I had to do to make a living.
But why a food truck instead of a restaurant?
It's just cost. Look at a restaurant, you're looking at $250,000 right out of the gate. A food truck is a reasonable opportunity to get in for a little bit less money.
And Chef Tito's nodding his head in agreement as you say that. You know, I assume you two believe that food trucks aren't a fad and they're here to stay. Are you sure about that?
Yep.
Why?
Why? Because the food truck business is growing. It's nice business, and you have a little bit more freedom in your life.
Yeah.
With your personal life.
And, Brett, you think the business is going to stick around and continue to grow?
I believe so. I think over the next few years, some of the weaker ones will be cut from the herd because we're kind of starting to hit market saturation, I think, in KC, because there's so many trucks rolling
out. How many trucks are out there? Do you know?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I would say upwards north of 100 at least.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Dan Stacks, does that sound right to you, 100 trucks out there?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, and why is the business taking off from your vantage point?
Well, I think that as both have shared, the cost for just starting it up versus a brick and mortar, that's really helped. And then the ability to be mobile and to be going to where your customer is.
Where are the best places in town, Brett, as you look around for food trucks? Is there like one hot spot in the greater metro area, or what do you point to?
I would point people down to the Crossroads District.
On a First Friday?
First Friday. Typically, I'm at the KC Star in their lot.
It's been a really popular place for food trucks to gather.
But they're out in droves around Crossroads. Also, West Bottoms. First Friday's down there. There'll be dozens.
Chef Tito, what's your favorite spot?
Well, the West Bottoms. Mm-hmm. West Bottoms, and here working in Overland Park, too.
Where in Overland Park?
You start Third Fridays.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the West Bottom, I think, for me, I'm stayed all the time over there.
I'm guessing on a First Fridays, downtown Kansas City Crossroads, your truck is absolutely packed to the max with produce and food and everything you've got. That's your Christmas time, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
Is that for same with you, Brett?
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
You those big nights, you just load as much on board as you can. And your only restriction is how much food you can carry.
How many employees do you have on a First Friday night on the truck?
Myself and usually three others.
Yeah. Chef Tito?
Me too.
Yeah. Well, Dan, you're sales manager of Mag Specialty Vehicles. How did Mag Specialty get into the food truck manufacturing business to begin with?
We actually started about 9 years ago. Two guys in college that started up sourcing trucks for the movie industry. That morphed into
for the movie industry.
Yeah, because they found
a niche. Movie like Hollywood.
Movie like Hollywood. Yeah, they were sourcing specific trucks for the movie industry. That morphed into sourcing trucks for FedEx. They found a niche market for FedEx contractors, where they started upfitting and building certain things for FedEx specifically. And then one thing led to another, and that just morphed into building custom trucks, mobile trucks being one of them.
Did you guys see the food truck craze coming and wonder if there wasn't a market share to grab there?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's, again, very entrepreneurial company, and they saw that coming and started building a few, found that there was a good market, and we're looking to double our production this year.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
Where do most of your clients live? Where are you sending your trucks?
All over. We go from the East Coast to the West Coast, even into Canada.
Can I ask how many did you put out last year?
About 60.
About 60?
Yeah.
And you think it's going to double this year?
Yes, sir.
Wow. Wow. What do you make of it?
It's exciting. It's something different every day. Because we're a custom market, we build different types of trucks for different types of people. And just depends on the type of food they want, how much refrigeration, all those types of things.
Tell me about the different options that you have. You say different types of trucks. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have two different types. We have a pre-engineered where we've got a model already set up and they can choose different things under the hood. And then we have a full custom where they can actually come to us and dream big and we build what they want, whether they want a 40-foot trailer or they want a 20-foot truck and all the bells and whistles, et cetera, in there.
What are three sort of options that need to be on a food truck, at least from your vantage point?
Yeah, refrigeration.
Of course. Okay.
Some type of storage, whether it's under counter or something along those lines. And then you have three sinks and a hand wash sink. Quiet generators or something.
Why three sinks?
Well, just that's you have to have a fresh water and then you've a cleaning sink, et cetera. So there's three sinks and then a hand wash. Most municipalities require that.
And the price range for these vehicles runs, just give me a range here.
Yeah, you can start somewhere, and for us at least, our pre-engineered starts somewhere in the 85, 90, and then they go up from there. Our trailers are a little bit less than that, probably starting around 60, 65, mm-hmm. and go up from there, all the way up to $250,000, $500,000.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
And you're shipping out some of those every year?
We are.
What's in a $250,000 food truck?
It's kind of funny that we're here at a radio station. We're actually doing a project for a radio station that we're going to put a mobile radio station with a food truck on the back.
No kidding.
And so that one's going to be upwards to the $500,000 mark. That one's going to go out probably mid to late summer. And just really excited to get started on the project.
Yeah. You know, Chef Tito, from your vantage point, what's the most important thing to have in a food truck? What do you have to have to make the thing work?
A bathroom.
That wasn't the right answer.
Well, we have a bathroom in our food trailer.
Yeah.
But the fifth thing is have a good refrigeration is your main thing, because that one you can keep freeze or refrigeration. You have enough building, and like mine, I have a smoker with 450 pounds of meat that give me the possibility to attend 1,000 people, okay?
And on a big night for you, you can serve 1,000 people out of that truck.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brett, how about you?
I don't have near that capability. About 200 would just really be pushing.
Do you come back and reload at that point?
No. After 200 people, I'm spent and my brain's fried and I want to go home and take a shower.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. What's the atmosphere like inside your food truck on a first Friday when you're going pedal to the metal?
It's total chaos.
Is it?
Controlled chaos. It's like you have your 4 square feet that you're allowed to work in, and you're spinning around inside that 4 square feet as fast as you can until the food's gone. So.
And it's draining, it sounds like.
Well, it's kind of something that I've only experienced in the food truck, where you work so hard and so fast, you don't even have time to think. And by the end of the service, your brain's just turned to mud and you can't even count your fingers.
Chef Tito, same with you?
Yes. Yes. When we are working, we don't have time to eat. We don't have time to spend nothing. You have to control and very focused on the tickets that you have and you're making, and to try to make the best service and the faster service to your customer, because sometimes you are in office or buildings or something that you don't have more than 25 minutes, 30 minutes to eat, and you have to make it very, very fast.
So speed is really, it
important.
Goes hand in hand with what
it's
you
very
guys
important.
Do. Yeah. Brett, you know, your 66 Avion, if I'm saying that right, has
yes.
curved sides that you describe as Twinkie-like. How difficult did the curved sides make retrofitting it for your kitchen?
It was bad. obviously, the only flat surface in that thing is the floor. And like I said, imagine a 25-foot-long Twinkie that's hollow on the inside and putting square kitchen equipment into it.
Well, why did you use that kind of trailer? What Airstream? Why didn't you try something else?
Well, that goes back to my original plans when I was drawing out plans for a trailer similar to Tito's, and realizing that now I'm going to have to buy a tow vehicle to pull this thing with.
Mm-hmm.
The light came on, and I had a 1967 Cadillac Fleetwood in my garage.
Wow. Which would go very nicely with that Airstream.
Yeah. I'll get a classic trailer, and hit Craigslist, and there was one right there, and went and picked it up the next day.
Was it the right decision in retrospect based on what you're saying, or do you have sort of buyer's remorse there?
Oh, yeah, there's buyer's remorse, but it's one of a kind, and not too much remorse because I bought another one last year. So,
Dan, you got an Airstream in the shop getting a makeover right now. What's different about this particular job?
Yeah, the Airstream, as Brett said, I mean, there's not too many straight parts of the Airstream. It's all curved, and so it takes a little bit more to put the inside, the walls, and things like that in to really make it look the way that you want it to.
Do your factory workers sort of moan when an Airstream trailer comes in the shop?
Actually, you know, just the contrary. They were excited.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, they look at it as a challenge, and they love it because as I'm walking through, you know, and they're doing the production and things like that, they grab me and, hey, look at this and look at that. And so they're really excited when something like that happens and we're able to really make it, you know, morph into what we want it to be.
Can you tell us who that customer is?
That one's actually, it was a Spartan, I think, is the one you're talking about. That one's going down right here on Southwest Trafficway. It was for Farmhouse.
What's the process you guys use to match clients with trucks and trailers?
Well, it's really exploratory. You know, when they first call, they want a food truck. And we start talking a little bit about it and asking, well, why are you wanting a food truck? Would a trailer suffice? Those types of things. And so it's just a back and forth communication process that we use initially.
Why would somebody want a food truck as opposed to just a trailer?
Well, the food truck, for the most part, they can get in and go. They don't have to go out and find a truck to move the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to worry about what the radius is to turn a lot of times. Sometimes turning a trailer takes a little bit more than just turning a truck of the same size.
Right.
So that's part of the reason.
Chef Tito, describe your high-end trailer to us. What do you have?
Well, I have a trailer. Mm-hmm. I have a trailer 40 foot long.
Wow.
It's
that's a big one.
It's a very big one. We have a 12 foot high. But like he say, is we have capacity to have a more volume. But the limitation where you go is short, because sometimes you can go in some neighborhood, you can cross because you are too high or you are too big and the corners are too narrow. And like if you go to an event, you have to be the first one, because if you are the you come
to find a place to park.
Find a place to park is so difficult.
Yeah. Did your sound system come with the model you chose, or was it extra cost?
Everything go extra.
Mm-hmm.
Everything. I have sound system. I have television. I have computers. I have bathrooms. I have 180 gallons of water.
Yeah. Now, you guys sometimes face issues with health department regulations and permits. Tell us about that, Brett. What are some of the issues you run up against? Because they keep a close eye on you guys.
They do. And being mobile, you don't just deal with one municipality. You'll deal with every county or township, wherever you're at.
Does that cost you money?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we carry upwards of a dozen permits for different areas.
Because if you go to Leawood, you have to have a permit to be in Leawood?
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, typically, they all look for the same thing. Your cold has to be cold. Your hot has to be hot and clean. And that's not hard to accomplish. Just keep your rig clean, and you don't have any fallout with the health departments anywhere. However, I do feel like there are some that are way understaffed, and it's very hard to deal with.
The health departments,
because their turnaround on their employees is terrible, and you're always dealing with
somebody new
kid, and they don't know what they're doing, and
mm-hmm.
it just makes it a nightmare to deal with it. But
is it a nightmare for you too, Chef Tito?
Well, we have most of the same people, but
yeah,
and you have to pay a lot of money. Like if the people say we don't go to pay money, we go pay a lot of money. Maybe like Brad and me, we go pay maybe like $3,000 a year in health department permits.
For all the different municipalities.
For all the different counties,
yeah.
Yes.
Hey, how rigorous are those inspections, Chef Tito?
Well, depends of the city.
Mm-hmm.
Depends of the city.
It varies.
But normally everybody are more or less in the same range.
Do you know when they're coming?
Nope.
They just show up.
They just show up.
And you don't know when they're coming either, Brett. Yeah.
Typically, you expect them. You know, that's really not a problem. Because, I mean, we're a restaurant. We'll get inspected once, maybe twice a year.
Yeah.
We have inspectors on board dozens of times a year. So it's your job to make that environment healthy and safe for all your customers.
You know, Dan Stacks, with your clients coming from so many different parts of the country,
How do you make sure you're creating a vehicle that meets, you know, their local health department regulations? And how big of an issue is that for you guys?
Yeah, we ask them to send us their guidelines from their local municipalities, wherever they're going to be using the vehicles, so that we can build towards that. But as Brett and Chef Tito said, you know, most of them, if you build one that's clean and can be kept clean very easily, have the hot water, have cold water for washing and cleaning up your supplies, et cetera. Most of the time, that kind of takes care of it.
You know, before we go, I got to ask you all about the outside of the truck, the wrap. That you call it the wrap, right?
Yes, sir.
The wrap that goes on, because that can go from fairly simple to very, very sophisticated.
Absolutely. Yeah, it can. It just depends on what the client is looking for at the end result. And they typically work with a graphic designer in order to do that and be able to match it up onto either the truck or the trailer platform. And then we do the installation from there.
What's your wrap, Chef Tito?
My wrap is the flat of the USA. Uh-huh. And the name is American Fusion. It's the fusion of all the American food that we make.
Mm-hmm.
We have capacity for everything, all the type of food. And like him, it's a piece of art. Because
yeah.
He put too much passion, Brad, in the whole trailer. It's passion. It's a piece of art because he's hand-make everything.
Is that right, Brett? Tell us about that. What does it look like?
The trailer?
Yeah.
Basically, what I did is I worked with two artists here locally in KC that I just basically gave them free range because I cook. I don't paint. So
yeah.
I just let them take over.
Okay, well, it's getting close to noon. I'm getting hungry. So what's the best thing your truck serves? What's your best dish, Brett?
You know, I did a thing a few weeks ago. It's the dumbest thing. My daughter and I were just goofing off in the kitchen one day, and I took and hollowed out a dill pickle and stuffed it with ground beef and pimento cheese and deep fried it. And people just went nuts over that thing.
What's it called?
Meat pickle.
Very, very sophisticated name there.
Yeah. Keep it classy.
The meat pickle.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're out at Wilma's Good Food Truck, look for the meat pickle.
Yeah. The biggest one, the meatloaf slider that I do, people just go, it's like blood in the water.
Chef Tito's giving you a thumbs up for that.
Oh, yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I tried to take it off the menu a couple years ago, and there was an uproar from the natives, so I had to put it back.
Chef Tito, how about you? What do you sell that's going to make
my
crazy?
My queen is the cochinita pibil. Cochinita pibil comes from the Mayan land. It's one recipe. There's a Mayan pork cooking on the ground. Pibil means cook on the ground.
Right.
We sell a lot of that one. We have a red condiments, and it's one of the best sellers.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
I want to thank you all for coming in and talking to us about the food truck business. Chef Tito, owner of American Fusion Food Truck and Catering. Chef Brett Atkinson, owner of Wilma's Good Food Truck. And Dan Stacks, who's sales manager of Mag Specialty Vehicles out in Grain Valley. Thank you all. Sounded great. That conversation originally took place in April. Download our podcast and listen to previous programs at kcur.org/up-to-date. Find us on Twitter. We're at KCURUpToDate. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's program, What Makes a President? We learned about Donald Trump from the viewpoint of a close advisor. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatakoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.